You're listening to Cosmic Perspective. I'm Andy Paneros. Today's guest is Bob Creelan. He is an author, astronomer, inventor, and an advocate for improving outdoor lighting. Bob, welcome.
Thank you.
To Cosmic Perspective.
Great to be here.
You're very passionate about improving outdoor lighting, and this has been kind of a crusade for you.
Yeah, you could call it that. You know, it was the kind of thing that I got into unexpectedly through amateur astronomy because someone might say, well, why would you be an advocate for improving outdoor lighting? I mean, you know, what could necessarily be wrong? I mean, it's dark at night. You want to see things. You want to feel more secure. You would put a lot of lights up and just keep putting them up because you're going to feel more secure. You know, following a conventional wisdom kind of path, you might come to that conclusion. But, you know, growing up, especially in the time that I did, watching us actually reach out into outer space because we could stand there as kids and look up at that night sky and say, wow, oh my goodness, it's a really big place out there. And so we, you know, this is the where the meeting of the outdoor lighting and the night sky, the actual clash of the two that got me into this. So, yeah, this is it's been a great journey, but a good one.
Lighting has an effect on all living things. Maybe you could explain a little bit to us about that.
Yeah, and I don't claim to be any expert, but the scientific findings that they have come out with now, actual studies particularly aimed at finding out how light affects us. And, you know, in a layman's sense, you know, I want to say that this is everything that we've found out about outdoor lighting and the negative impact of it, like how it masks our view of the stars at night and how it can glare in our eyes and make it actually more difficult to see instead of helping us if it's not used well. All these things, they're all win-wins for us, so to actually improve upon. But as you mentioned, how does it physiologically help, you know, impact us? Or we know that it helps us see better if used well. You turn on a light in a dark area, it can help you. But the what they're finding out through the scientific research is, and this is, it correlates with many things we're finding out about our physiology, that we're built for the environment the way it was in nature, where you had a daylight, which was very, very bright, and it would softly transition into the darkness of night. And then at the end of night, we'd softly transition slowly back into the brightness of day. And this is the kind of daily cycle that we are built for because it's been, you know, depending on what you believe, a very, very long time that we have grown up in this kind of environment. So we have evolved to be timed to this day and night cycle. And our hormonal cycle, the releasing of very important hormones in our bodies, are very much attuned to the changes in light. And in a simple way, you can think of this like the way we've learned about how trees lose their leaves. And I remember learning this in grammar school that, you know, we all initially might think, oh, well, it's getting cold. So that, you know, that tells the trees, okay, it's time to, you know, get ready for winter. But we found that it was actually the shortening length of the light of day that is the trigger that is telling leaves and plants that, oh, okay, a very hard season, cold, all the stresses of winter are coming, so that they prepare for it through the signal of the change in light and the shortening of the day. We also have these kind of mechanisms in us, and so believe it or not, we've got an annual cycle, and this is what they've discovered through the research. So how does it affect us when we change that? And this is, we've changed it in the span of as long as we've been on Earth. It's been a very, very short period because Thomas Edison invented the actual electric light bulb in the late 1800s. And before that, we had some lesser type of light forms like candles and gas light and so forth. I say lesser because they're nowhere near as bright as an electric light. So, you know, in the big scheme, it hasn't been that long. So now we're finding how having the presence of light when it's supposed to be dark outside for us, or dark inside, depending on, you know, where you are, this is really changing. And, you know, I know that was a long rant, but I wanted to sort of, you know, set the stage for, right, how does that impact us? And what the science is showing us is that it's inhibiting our release of especially melatonin, a very, very important hormone that is key to balancing the release of other hormones that we have, like in women, especially estrogen. This is a very, very balanced cycle. And so that if we throw that off, if we suppress one or the other, health problems can surface. And this is what's come from learning about, how is bright light at night impacting us? And, it's very, very eye-opening research, and there's a lot of information that online. David Blask is one of the key researchers, as well as, and I cannot forget to mention, Dr. Richard Stevens, a good friend of mine here at the UConn Health Center, who was one of the first to actually come to the conclusion that that light at night could have some correlation with cancer. And I say for him, could, but the research is becoming more and more definitive that we are really, there's a clear line of proof now that suppressing the melatonin through light exposure is really not good for the mechanisms that keep us healthy. And so one of the outcomes is if we have time, I'll talk about it in more detail. David Blass' research, which it's really interesting to see how he did it to come to the conclusion that light at night can actually, produce a situation where cancer can actually thrive because of the suppression of melatonin.
And there's been quite a bit of research done in the last few years, and all in light polluted areas and non light polluted areas. Correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that we were talking just before we came on about a particular study in Israel where they took it a step further, where they actually took the satellite photos of the Israel at night in particular. A lot of us have seen the pictures of light at night around the world where we see the glowing, United States. You can actually see the outlines.
From space,
from space, yeah. Exactly. And they did the same thing when they isolated the Israel itself and looked at the brightest areas, the ones that were persistently bright with ambient light, meaning that the light that you could see from space, there was so much of it, and it was penetrating everything in that area. So they looked at the incidence of breast cancer in those areas compared to the areas that were not brightly lit, soaked in light all night long. And they found there was a much greater recordable incidence of breast cancer in these areas. And it was amazing how it correlated specifically to the brightly lit areas versus the darker, more rural, far out country areas. And the thing is, for us, yes, you can be in your house, you could turn off the lights, you have control of that. But if you're in an area where you are just surrounded with the saturation of light, it's leaking into your bedroom at night and so forth. And that's why these kind of things it's a really big alarm to be sounding now, because we have such a great like breast cancer in particular of cancers is one that is the it's off the charts as far as comparison to 20, 30 years ago. It is one of the most prominent cancers, and we've been looking for the smoking gun. Is this it? We don't know for sure, but it's raising some serious questions about it.
The research certainly points a lot towards it. That's for sure at this point, that the data that we've been receiving from studies that are being done.
Exactly.
And I try to tell, I'm glad you're on the show, because I try to tell people this all the time. They look at me like I've got two heads. So maybe they'll listen to you, because I think it's really important that people understand that cycle, that cycle that we have.
Well,
particularly women.
It's easy to not think about it in the kind of world we've constructed around us. We remove ourselves more and more from the natural processes. And some of us may have heard recently about diet. We're starting to realize that, if we just stop for a second and say, all right, well, in nature, how would we eat? And I say in nature, meaning remove us from the supermarkets and all this kind of stuff like that. Not saying that that's what we have to do, but let's at least use this as the starting point of how would we eat? Think about if you had to hunt your meat, How often would you be eating meat? Probably not as often as we eat meat. And so we grew up in this world and evolved to be a much more plant-eating based organism than we are today. We eat a lot of meats because it's right there laid out in a beautiful package for
us. High protein.
Yeah, yeah. And there are benefits to that. Yes, protein, obviously we need protein. But, you know, my point is, because that's a whole different conversation, is really that what they're finding in diet is that if you look at in nature how we would approach eating, the diet that you'd lay out before you, and I don't care if you get it from your supermarket or if you grow it in your garden or whatever, would be a lot different than what most of us eat. And so we can still go to the grocery store and buy an entirely different kind of diet that's based more on what our natural cycle would be and probably be a lot healthier because of it. And that's what the research is showing. So now take light. Would we be in bright lights at night? You know, and watching a bright TV screen throwing out a lot of those blue-colored wavelengths that the sun produces, that's really changing the way our physiology is designed to work. So, you know, this is it's an eye-opener, and it's a revelation to a lot of people. But, you know, in a simple sense, try brightening up all your lights when it's getting near bedtime and see, number one, if you're you're feeling as tired as you might normally, and also see if you can try to actually go to sleep when it's bright in your room. And you might actually be able to nod off, but that real deep sleep that you normally go into, you're going to have trouble with that. Conversely, try dimming the lights after dinner time, you know, sitting in a much dimmer environment, you know, bring things down a bit. You're going to find that you're going to want to go to sleep because this is your natural cycle, you know. This is the kind of thing that we don't necessarily think about because we're in this 9-to-5 zoom world, you know, and checking our email and Facebook and all this kind of stuff on a constant basis. It really pulls us away from what we were raised, you know, in this right. over these, you know, this long history of our period here on Earth, you know. And I stay away from numbers because I know people believe many different lengths of how long we've been here. So I don't even want to go there, you know. But it's been a darn long time.
And yes, it has. And of course, we don't think about nature and wildlife. We talked about how it affects humans.
Yeah.
But it also affects just the light of day itself affects when birds migrate. And so stray light also affects them, and you can explain it a lot better than me, Bob. So I'm going to let you explain.
You know, and I'm just going to mention a independent film that's going around because this is a great way to see it. It's called The City Dark, and this is a great independent film that you can find around. It's not an online thing yet. You might be able to get it through your Netflix and so forth. I don't know, but The City Dark was an independent film done that explains all these different aspects, including the nature aspect that Andy's mentioning. And what you're seeing through this new understanding is that with birds and so forth, I mean, it's not just birds. It's all living things because we're all tuned to this cycle. So birds are finding in bright areas to be confused by the bright light because they are not, they're not finding the normal signals they would find in the night sky, like stars and horizon lines that they could see in a dark environment. They're now going towards these bright things, especially when there's like spotlights pointed straight up into the sky. You know, bright. For an example, the tribute to the Twin Towers in New York. They blasted extremely bright blue lights up in the sky, which was a wonderful visual tribute. Beautiful. I'm an artist, so I can appreciate the artistic statement. But what they were finding and why they don't keep them on all the time is the birds come and they circle around those lights trying to figure out, where did daytime come from, you know? And so they wind up dying from exhaustion and falling to the ground because they're not supposed to be flying around at night, you know, thinking it's daytime, trying to find their daytime routine. It throws everything off. So and everyone knows, you leave a light on your back porch or something. If it's not one of those yellow bulbs, you're going to see dead bugs all on the ground in the morning or stuck to the bulb, you know, because you're now changing a very, very important signal in our environment that we're all tuned to. sea turtles in Florida, big issue. They have strong laws on the beaches to not have bright lights or direct lights that they can see on the beaches, because the sea turtles come in, which are already an endangered species in many cases. They come in to lay their eggs on the beach. And if they're not confused enough, the mothers, to dig their holes and lay their eggs, they, once they've done that and find their way back to the water, if they do that, I say if they do, because sometimes they just crawl towards the lights, they lay their eggs, and the babies are attuned through the evolution to just come up and crawl towards the soft glow that is in the ocean that we don't perceive as much, or the starlight over the water, to be able to crawl towards that. Now, you can imagine that is really soft, soft illumination. You have one, I don't care if it's a 25-watt light bulb, visible in the other direction, and this is what happens. The babies come up, they crawl out, and they crawl towards the streets and the houses, and they wind up dying, being picked up by predators, run over by cars. They're just drying up because they're a sea-based animal. And,
confused by artificial light.
Yeah. So it's really, there's a big... there's a lot of laws, and there's a big movement to protect those species down there. But, you know, this is all being found out after we've lit the environment so brightly. You know, you can imagine. I mean, just go on any even suburban area now, and you'll see there's a lot of light there that, if that wasn't there, it'd be a very, very different environment.
Bob, the thing I'd like to talk to you the most about is misconceptions about lighting and security. That's a big issue for everyone. Everyone thinks that the more light you have, the more secure you are.
Yeah, well, conventional wisdom would make you think that. Who would not think that, okay, I it's a dark area around me outside. I've got to change it to something I feel safer in. During the day, peripheral vision is something that gives us the most comfort. Peripheral vision meaning that you look forward and you're noticing that you can also see on your sides very, very well. That's the way our eyes work. They're wonderful optical instruments, and you benefit the most from having light to get that peripheral vision. Now, at night, when you're limited by the darkness, we are built to see in a very limited sense at night. Our eyes are built for that. But, you know, there's also, the fact that you notice that you're inclined to sleep at night because your body needs to restore itself. That's just a natural thing. I hope that's not news to anybody, because I know some people that, man, I don't know how they do it. You know, get by on maybe a nap, you know, every day. But the thing about, now, nighttime, you feel less safe when you don't have your peripheral vision, because now you're limited by this darkness. So the conventional wisdom would be, okay, let's put up lights, and the brighter the better, then I'll be able to see. This will make it more secure. My peripheral vision will improve, and I'll feel that sense of security that I have, because I feel like I can pick up on anything that's going on around me like I do during the day. So how the eye works, this is the interesting thing. The eye is not designed for lighting the way it is designed for daylight and nighttime, where you've got one big light source up there in that sky, the sun, which is lighting around us, and it's really mostly out of your line of sight, meaning you're not looking right at it. Maybe it's sunset or sunrise where you notice that, boy, when that's right in your eyes, that's like even harder to see. And lighting at night with electric lighting can tend to become more like those sunsets and sunrises, because you've now got this dark background surrounding you, and then this bright hot spot of light, which is generally lower to your line of view because, you know, the poles only go so high. The sun, you know, can get way above us, but the lighting is now more in your line of sight. So if you're looking at the glare of the light, now your eye is trying to figure out, okay, I'm designed for that big bright surround of light, but now I have this hot spot of brightness in front of me, and that's enough to make your eye say, okay, it's daytime. So your eye now adjusts, and you know, you've probably all noticed how your pupils tend to constrict and get smaller when it's bright, and that's a protective measure, because that's you adapt to the light better. And in the dark, your pupils open up and widen, and then you were able to see much better in the dim light of night or darkness. And so when your eye sees that bright hot spot of a electric light in a dark environment, your eye closes down to be more like in a daylight position. So all you're going to perceive is that bright hot spot. Everything around you becomes a blind zone. So contrary to what you're trying to do increase visibility in a dark environment, when you have a bright hot spot of light like that, you now are you're preventing visibility. So how do you deal with that? The thing is it's that bright hot spot. That is the thing that changes the whole game. You need to be able to transition the world of darkness with light in a sense that, in a way that is a softer transition. So there's no bright hot spot anymore, that you're now looking at the illumination of the area around you, but not the source of light. The source of light is the problem. So when people approach security lighting, it's often big, bright, you know,
sodium lights.
Well, yeah, I mean, just bright and big and large, and not thinking so much about hiding that bright source of light, because, you know, you really don't need that much light to be able to see at night and see well peripherally. But if you have that hot spot of light, that changes the way your eye works. So it's how the eye works. And this is, again, going back to, let's get back to in nature, how do things function? And your eye needs to not have to be thinking it's daytime by looking at that bright. Because even if it's just a pinpoint of really, really bright light, your eye adjusts to it. So you get rid of that by shielding the actual bright part of the light. Then everything that falls on the ground around becomes the soft illumination that your eye can now measure against the darkness, and you can then see in both. Your peripheral vision returns. So you now feel that sense of safety. So contrary, that's the crazy thing about it, is that contrary to conventional wisdom, you might think, big bright lights, and then I can see everything at night. Whereas it's not that as much as being shield the light so that you can get the soft lighting around you. Then your eye can say, I can see the soft lighting, and my eye is still pretty wide open so that I can also see the dim areas, and you get that peripheral vision back. Your sense of safety returns. So this is, it's just designing lighting around the way the eye works, as opposed to what we've done for so many years of just putting up these big honking floodlights and blasting everything, which goes not only in your yard, but the neighbor's yard and the neighbor, you know, in the next neighborhood's yard, you know, which is the crazy part about it. So, you know, and you might not think of that as crazy, but, you know, if someone's got a floodlight shining in your bedroom window, it might make you think about that a little bit.
You're a co-inventor of a light. I guess you could consider full cutoff lighting. Is that the correct?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, and I have one. You can take your wattage and cut it down considerably because it shines light down into a confined area. Another thing I like to ask you about is also burning all the extra fossil fuels that we burn because we use too much light and too much wattage.
Right. It all ties together. Yeah, I mean, exactly what you're talking about. You had mentioned the light I invented is called the Glare Buster. And basically, it was the first version of something that existed made for homeowners so that they could use on their home because there wasn't anything available. So it became the first one for the homeowner. But, you know, here's the irony. As part of my talks, I have this book here called The New Era of Street Lighting. It comes from 1918.
1918.
And this was when electric lighting was first starting to come into the public world out there, where they were starting to sell the idea of lighting streets and so forth. And the irony is, they write in there how to use street lighting thing. There's two simple sentences in here that basically say that they knew what they were doing right from the beginning. First one, it says, as a first result of this study, it was apparent that the light above the horizontal must be conserved and sent downward. It makes sense. I mean, you're not trying to light the bottoms of clouds and the bellies of birds and, you know, things up there. That's just wasted light. So must be conserved and sent downward. So they were right on there. The other thing is, glare serves seriously to reduce the discerning power of the eye. And that's exactly what I was just talking about. How the eye is able to see or not see in the presence of light depends on how you use the light. So you had mentioned full cutoff lighting. What does full cutoff mean? It fully cuts off the light that would go horizontally out or above the horizontal. And that's what's being fully cut off. All the light then goes downward and illuminates the areas that you need to see, your walkways, your streets, the surrounds around your home or your buildings. So just like they had figured out in 1918, that's the way you light to better see. Now, just the second point you made is that, all right, well, how does that tie into energy use? And this is why, see, every point that we make here about lighting, outdoor lighting, and using it better is a win-win for everybody, because we can spend enormous amounts of money. As a matter of fact, I mean, I've got this old International Dark Sky Association, which I'll talk about later, the main organization that has been out there for years working to educate the public about this. This is an old flyer of theirs, and they estimated that about 30% of all outdoor lighting in the USA is going straight up into the sky. 30% of it. And we spend a lot of money. And at this time, and this was back in the late 80s, they estimated about that 30% is to generate that is about $1.5 billion just to generate the wasted light. And that to produce that, it takes about 6 million tons of coal a year just in the USA to produce the 30% of wasted light. So it's when you start putting dollars and cents to it and just electrical use, you start to realize that, wow, this is crazy. But it's such an easy one to fix. It's just a matter of being aware. So, your show is such a wonderful vehicle to be able to bring this information to your listeners that, we can do this better and be able to save all these things, do not impact the environment and not impact our physiology as much, as well as save energy and actually wind up with better lighting that you're going to be more secure in because you can see.
Now, the great point is now is that, and I know you've been part of this, is that there are some laws in Connecticut that actually help reduce outdoor lighting, light pollution, to the extent that only where we need it. Now, I'm not sure the laws, maybe you can help me a little bit out with that.
Absolutely. I have to mention, it's very important I mention Leo Smith, a friend and advocate who I've worked with for years, because he and I were very... We were a great team working together with the state legislature on actually passing three very, very important laws. And he's even gone on to bring other building code upgrades and stuff like that beyond what we did with the state laws. In 1995, I went to speak before the legislators in the state about... a law that was proposed by, I forgot where the gentleman was from, but he's no longer in the legislature, but he proposed a lighting law that would actually reduce the lighting usage outside to the minimum we needed for visibility and, where shielding could be used. And this was to cover any state-funded lighting, especially for roadways. So I got up and spoke for this and worked with the legislators and found that we actually were able to get it passed in 1995. So that was pretty pioneering, because that's quite some time ago and there wasn't a lot of laws out there. But the interesting thing, and this is where Leo stepped in, is he basically did the follow-up research and said, this is a great law, but we need to take it another step further, because most roadways throughout the state where these lighting problems are not funded by the state. They're funded by the municipality. So we went in and fixed that. And by 2001, we updated the law to say all streets, when they replace lights, and this is why it's not costing us any extra money, because when they replace the lights, not that they had to run in and do it tomorrow. No, it was one of those things that when they replace the lights, they would actually be replacing all street lights throughout the state of Connecticut, whether they were municipally funded or state funded, with the full cutoff type of lighting, which would shine down. And anyone can go out and look at their street lights throughout the state of Connecticut, and you will notice that some of them will have a flat bottom on them, and some of them will have like a sort of glass or plastic bowl that hangs down. And those are the old ones that have that light lens that hangs down and that you can see, from your bedroom window or whatever at night. The ones with the flat bottoms are the new ones as per this 2001 law. And that, you know, many streets that you'll look, you'll see they'll have all the flat lenses, because this has been going on starting in 1995 and then 2001. And they only last so long. Streetlights only last so long. So when they need to change them, by law, by Connecticut state law that we passed in 2001, they have to go to the flat lens. And just to mention, in addition to that, even more important for light pollution, you may notice on the telephone poles and the utility poles that often near businesses there'll be those big floodlights that they'll that they generally offer to businesses, right, through the power company programs, which shine diagonally towards these businesses along the sides of the road. And these guys are have been a huge source of not only light pollution, because they just spray light everywhere, but light trespass into people's neighborhoods, into drivers' eyes, creating an actual driver hazard. So in 2003, we passed, which I consider the most important of all the three bills, which said that throughout the state, whenever these floodlights are used, and they had a period to actually change them over, most of them have already been, but they have to be, when they use those floodlights, they have to be shields added to them and aimed in a way so that, number one, they don't shine into the roadway, and the parameters are pretty straight ahead. If you're driving by the one of these lights, if you're right, you know, near the pole, I mean, you might see the light source. But as you're approaching it, where it's the most critical and it would be shining in your eyes, it needs to be shielded. And the other point is that they can't shine beyond the property line into neighboring areas, especially residential areas. So you'll notice these floodlights that are on these utility poles now are aimed down, have shields on them, because they need to meet the requirements of this law, which was passed in 2003. And this was with a lot of work that Leo Smith and myself did on this. And it's one of the proudest accomplishments I've ever done, because, you know, you can bring about these kind of changes, and everybody really wins in the end, because who wants a floodlight blaring in their window all night long? If not just for the aesthetic problem there, you know, but you don't want that keeping you awake or messing with your melatonin release, yeah, you know, or knocking the stars out of the sky for you, because you have one bright light. I don't care if it's three neighborhoods away, if it's in your line of sight, it makes it so hard for you to even just see those beautiful stars up there in the night sky.
How can people get involved, or how can they learn more about light pollution and how to change it? Let's say they've got a light that's glaring in their window every night, a street light or a light from a business, a local business.
There's one really good central source, and I had mentioned this earlier, the International Dark Sky Association. This is an organization that's been around since the 80s, and they are devoted solely to educating the public on using outdoor lighting better. It was started, like I got into this, through amateur astronomy, And actually professional astronomy. These were some professional astronomers down in Arizona that began this organization because they saw the quickly encroaching bad lighting. And I'm going to say bad lighting because it was just sprawling all over the place near very, very light-sensitive observatories studying the night sky in some of the most beautiful skies in this country, in the Southwest. So they got this started because they realized once you're aware, it's, as I mentioned, a win-win situation for everybody to be able to make these changes, these simple changes, and we wind up, you know, using lighting better, seeing better, using less energy, and, you know, polluting our environment less. And as a fringe benefit, you get the night sky back. How wonderful. The International Dark Sky Association, as I mentioned, the way to find out about them is darksky.org, darksky.org. That's the International Dark Sky Association. The enormous amount of resources there. Local astronomy clubs, really good place to not only meet up with like-minded people that enjoy and share the night sky, but a group of like-minded people can also help talk to your local town, your local city, which is what I did. I passed a law in this town of Brantford, Connecticut, when I was living there back in the 90s, and was able to actually write a law that a lot of other municipalities across the country have wound up pulling from to write a law in their own hometown, because it's the kind of thing that once you understand it, you can do this very, very simply and just get businesses and everyone else to use lighting better. And it has been such an enormous success in the town of Brantford. If anyone ever gets, any of our listeners here, get to the town of Brantford, drive down Route 1 and just notice how the lighting is contained to the site. It's all through this law that was passed in 1997. Any other resources? Outdoor lighting is becoming more and more available, including for homeowners now, that would be shielded or aimable so that you can control where your light goes. International Dark Sky Association, the website I mentioned earlier, is also a great place to actually find a lot of these places that supply the lights.
Yeah, they have a whole section on, I believe, on
absolutely,
where to find lighting.
Absolutely, and a lot of good recommendations on what really works, because sadly, like in anything, there are sometimes through manufacturers, misunderstandings of what real good lighting is. International Dark Sky Association can help you with that.
You're listening to Cosmic Perspective. Our guest is Bob Creelan, and we're talking about light pollution. Bob, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was a wonderful discussion. I'm glad that you can help me educate the public that we should all know about light pollution and how it affects us and how we can get help. So thanks very much again today for being on the show.
No, this is great. What you're doing is exactly the kind of thing that would help get this message out there. It's a win-win for everybody, and absolutely. You can find out more.
I want to get your contact information. Also, you have a website?
Yes. BobCreelan.com. BobCreelin.com. You can find out about the book, There Once Was a Sky Full of Stars, as well as how to get in touch with the International Dark Sky Association.